Well, good morning, everyone. What a beautiful, beautiful morning. Good morning to those here at Brightstream Temple, and those at Wall Street, and those out in the McLeod realm, wherever you may be. And happy Easter. Now you may be wondering, did she say Easter? No, I said Easter. And you might have wondered, why is she recognizing a Christian holiday here in the Zendo? But Easter, in fact, was the goddess of dawn in ancient Europe. And when I Googled how to pronounce her name, I got three different results. Easter, Ustre, Ustre, or Yaustre, spelled E-O-S-T-R-E. And her companion animal was a hare or rabbit. And she was sometimes depicted with the head of a hare in the body of a woman. And Easter's hare was believed to lay the egg of new life to herald the rebirth of a new year, because of course the new year was the beginning, more traditionally they used the lunar calendar and the beginning of spring. And then as Christianity spread and overlaid the ancient ways through Europe, the spring festival dedicated to Easter became Easter, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Easter's hare or rabbit became
Easter Bunny.
The Easter Bunny. The old agricultural name for the April full moon was the hare moon. I love how yearly religious ceremonies so often have their roots in the earth, going back to the most ancient of human cultural ways of expressing our relationship to the earth, the planets, the animals, the changing seasons. When Michael and I lived in Japan, one of our great pleasures was attending various seasonal festivals and ceremonies, both in the city and out in rural villages. There are lots and lots, and they're still practiced. People turn out for these, and specific to regions, specific to areas, so they're kind of inexhaustible, going to see these different festivals. In Japan, Buddha's birthday is called the Flower Festival, Hanamatsuri, and it's celebrated on April 8th, which would be next week, but we're actually going to bump it 1 week ahead. This year. In earlier times, it would have been the full moon of the fourth month in the lunar calendar, and it still is in China and Korea. At that time, the time of spring flowering, right? So I remember at the entrances to the train station, little kids in their little, you know, blue and pink uniforms would be passing out packets of flower seed, going, Hanamatsuri, Hanamatsuri. Extremely cute. In the Jewish tradition, Passover celebrated the exodus of the Israelites, and still does celebrate the exodus of the Israelites from slavery in Egypt, and also comes in spring, this year beginning April 22nd. But some years it comes very close to Easter. This year it will happen to be Earth Day, actually, April 22nd, when Passover begins. But apparently in ancient times, the celebration was timed to be in the spring, when the barley could be harvested for making unleavened bread. That became a Passover tradition. And so it's no accident that Easter and Passover sometimes coincide. because the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus occurred during Passover when he had traveled to Jerusalem for the occasion. Tomorrow is April 1st, and April is the month of Ramadan in Islamic tradition, marking the revelation of the scriptures to the Prophet Muhammad. Again, a time of fasting and prayer central to that tradition. In my limited research, I couldn't find a link with spring, but I can't help wondering if there is one.
There's not, it's actually a lunar calendar.
So yeah.
It changes. Every year, Ramadan is slightly different. It moves around the year.
So it can be at a completely different season.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, there is often a convergence of holy days in the spring from many, many traditions. Here in the traditional territory of the Coast Salish people, one name for the April full moon is the moon of singing robins. And I'm sure many of you have begun to enjoy the morning chorus of birdsong already these days. At our house, we hear the robins. There's one that is persistently attacking its own reflection in the mirror, one of our windows. But what we have heard most is the varied thrushes. And I don't think you have them so much in the city, but they have this beautiful quavering flute-like note, kind of mournful, very evocative. And we've been hearing them a lot the past week or so. And the chickadees and juncos and song sparrows and towhees as well. They're the usual suspects who have been around all winter and then they start singing in the spring. And there will be others who haven't yet arrived. We saw the first Rufous hummingbird a couple days ago. And the males come first, and they always arrive just when you see the first salmonberry blossoms. As soon as I see the salmonberry blossom, then I look and there's a rufous hummingbird. And there are the flickers and sapsuckers and pileated woodpeckers squawking and pounding on trees and telephone poles in their efforts to establish territories and find mates. It really is a time of emergence from dormancy, budding, flowering, mating, nesting. Those of you who grew up with Easter may remember the plastic grass that our parents lined Easter baskets with, and the chocolate eggs and the hard-boiled eggs dyed with food coloring and hidden for Easter egg hunts. Some of them were easy to find for the little kids, and some so well hidden that they weren't found until much later. But did we ever wonder what the Easter Bunny had to do with the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ? I never questioned that. There are Christian sects that consider Easter too pagan and don't celebrate it in that way. And technically, they're right. Of course, we know that the Easter Bunny doesn't lay eggs. Rabbits have their young in burrows in the ground, in warm, dry nests lined with grass and fur. And their young are born with eyes closed, nearly hairless, quite helpless. Hares, on the other hand, there's a difference between rabbits and hares. They're not the same thing, right? Hares, like the wild snowshoe hares we have here, are born in sheltered above ground nests with eyes open and plenty of fur. Within a week, they are able to start actively foraging and feeding. Birds are like this too, right? Some species hatch from the egg naked and blind and helpless, little robins. You ever seen baby birds all naked? They don't have their feathers yet. And others come out maybe feathered, kind of fuzzy and fluffy looking, like little ducks, ducklings, and they're able to walk or swim or feed pretty much right away. So the first kind, the little naked blind ones, are called altricial, and the second, precocial, as in precocious, right? Just in case you like vocabulary words, which kind are you? Are you a little reluctant to emerge from your cozy, secure nest, needing a little extra protection? Or are you ready to go, kick up your heels and run for life? Eastern cottontail rabbits, the kind I grew up with, are altricial and particularly challenging for volunteers in wildlife rescue facilities. A while back, I read a book called The Love of Impermanent Things by Mary Rose O'Reilly. Catholic born and raised, became a Quaker in adulthood and a Buddhist student of Thich Nhat Hanh in middle age. She calls herself a Quaker Buddhist. Besides being a university English professor, she volunteers at a wildlife rescue facility. And she tells how difficult it is to feed infant eastern cottontail rabbits, the altricial kind, to make sure you get the eyedropper of kitten formula into their tiny little mouths without getting it in their nose. How when you lift them from their nest to feed them, they struggle and sometimes let out a piercing scream way out of proportion to their size. She says this, they miss the furry pile of brothers and sisters. They have no idea they aren't each other until that horrible moment of separation. And then she repeats that poignant statement, they have no idea they are not each other. What a striking phrase, I thought. And we humans do not know we are each other. We forget so early on. I'm sure that was her intended irony. The burgeoning of life force in the spring is so powerful, at least in temperate climates like our own, where the four seasons are distinct. It's a direct sensory explosion of color, sound, fragrance, texture, taste. And also in its metaphorical associations with rebirth, resurrection, redemption, even recreation. We want to get outside. We want to be by the water, in the forest. We want to be hiking, walking, picnicking, working in our gardens, maybe even swimming for those who plunge in. I wonder if the growth of spring, the emergence from dormancy of trees and bulbs and hibernating animals, I wonder if that first sparked the notion of the afterlife for humans. You know, we're buried in the earth, and then what? Then what? How, you know, I think when we first became conscious as human beings of death, we found it so fundamentally unbelievable. How can a being be so full of life in one moment and so empty of life the next? For any of us who've been present at a death, we've witnessed that with a kind of awe. Where did that life energy go? What just happened here? As I was writing this, I was thinking about our two cats that died in the last several years. One suddenly, just like that, seconds. He probably had a sudden arrhythmia. He was only 8 years old. He was so alive, bursting through the cat door to greet us in his usual way. And then, so still. And it took a long time for for his body to cool. He had been so alive. And then our old cat, who was maybe 18 or 19, faded so slowly. His body was cooling before he even died. That happens with humans too. Sometimes death comes like that, slowly, almost imperceptibly, and suddenly like a thunderbolt. So no wonder we humans in so many cultures have devised stories about life and death to offer us some understanding and comfort, to give us hope for some kind of continuation. Right? No wonder. But mixed in with that mystery often is this other big question in human life of good and evil, right? Of the beneficial and harmful actions we have done in the course of our life and their consequences. I am no scholar of the history of religion, but I wonder when that first concept of after-death punishment and reward came to us. Punishment and reward dealt out by greater than human powers that we call gods or one all-powerful God. And the first concepts of heaven and hell, the realms where the dead experience those rewards or punishments. And when the concept of rebirth or reincarnation first arose in human history, prehistory. So I'm not going to venture into the territory of comparative religion or theology this morning. It's far beyond me. There are differences and arguments about those fine points of the afterlife, even within each tradition. I tend to see all those stories about the great mystery of birth, of what we call in Zen, the great matter of birth and death, of life and death. I tend to see all those stories as artifacts of human culture that may have beauty and depth and meaning, great meaning, but that ultimately fall short of full explanation of what's beyond our capacity to fully know. I found this quote from the poet, writer, and peace activist, American Grace Paley, about her response to the great mystery. She says, "I don't think in terms of being an atheist or not. I would just say that we live in mystery and the making of this world is simply great and mysterious. I was listening just this morning to a man talking about finding rocks that were 4 billion years old. So we live in mystery. I'm not unsatisfied with that. I don't have to find a God or not a God." There's a quote, I don't remember who said it. "Find me a God because I am full of prayers." I think my husband could be described this way. He's an old Episcopalian boy. He has lost his God, but I think he's full of prayers. "I'm not full of prayers, I'm full of language," she says. She was a character. I think the prayers and the language we are full of are sometimes not even bound by language. Yeah, some of them are without words. But when it comes to words and this time that I'm talking about, and these questions that I'm talking about, the word redemption comes up. The act of saving or being saved from sin or error or evil. And this is a word that doesn't come up much in English translations of Buddhist teachings, but the verb to save or be saved certainly does, right? To save all we vow, to save all beings from suffering, that's our bodhisattva vow. And I haven't taken the time to research and probe what the earliest word, the Pali word, would have been for that. It's that core of the Bodhisattva's vow, not to step off the wheel of birth and death into Buddhahood until all beings are free from suffering and the causes of suffering, our greed, hatred, and delusion. The Christian belief is that Christ died and was resurrected to redeem sinful humanity, and that if we believe in him faithfully as our Savior, we will be granted everlasting life in a heavenly realm. The story of Christ's persecution, death, and resurrection is dramatic and deeply moving. It's also a powerful metaphor or trope, even if not taken literally. It expresses our human yearning to be free not only from death, but from our own delusion, our own greed, hate, and delusion, and our fear of death. The Buddha actually, though, never promised to save us, did he? How remarkable in a great spiritual teacher. In his words to the Sangha before he died, he said, "Be a lamp unto yourself. The Dharma and the practice I have given you will be your teacher when I am gone." He entrusted our salvation to us, to our ongoing practice. In the Dhammapada, which is a very early verse record of the Buddha's teachings, he says, "We are our own protection. We are indeed our own secure abiding. How could it be otherwise? So with due care, we attend to ourselves." So there's our practice, to attend to mind and body and world. How could it be otherwise? Jesus himself said, "The kingdom of God will not come with signs, nor will they say, 'Look here, look there,' for indeed the kingdom of God is within you." The great Christian mystics knew this truth and wrote about it. And even the Buddha hedged his bets on rebirth and in reincarnation. You may have heard us talk about when the Buddha met with a clan. I think they were a clan, people called the Kalamas. You know, the Buddha traveled and he came to this place where the Kalamas lived, and they challenged him with a difficult question. "There are so many holy men passing through. They all claim to have the truth. How can we know who to follow?" Right? We could say that just as well today. And he replied, "Don't be satisfied with hearsay or with tradition or with legendary lore or what's in the sutras or with logic or your personal preferences or the person's reputation as a teacher. No celebrity Buddhism. The way to discernment," he told them, "is to put the teachings into practice in your daily life. And if they lead to suffering and harm, do not follow them. And if they lead to well-being and happiness, follow them." And then he went on to say that if you live a life of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy, those are the Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes, extending to all beings, then you will find comfort. And then he said what the comforts are. First comfort is, if there's an afterlife, you will reap the rewards of your beneficial actions. After death, you will be reborn into such a life. The second is, if there is no afterlife, you can live this life happily, free from hostility, affliction, and anxiety. Third comfort, if there is karmic retribution, punishment, in the afterlife for harmful actions, you will be free of it, if you live in this way, right? And fourth is, if there is no retribution in the afterlife, you have freedom in this life. Buddha said that. This sounds a little bit like a Buddha's version of Pascal's wager. Have you heard of Pascal's wager? Here's what Wikipedia says about Pascal's wager. God is or God is not. Reason cannot decide between the two alternatives. Imagine that a game is being played where you flip a coin, heads or tails will turn up. God exists, God doesn't. You must flip that coin. You must wager. You must wager. So then let's gain away the gain and loss in wagering that God is. And estimate these two chances. If you gain all. If you lose nothing. Right? If we wager that God is. Now I'm going to pause here to say that when it comes to the law of karma, it's not a matter of all or nothing. It's always a mixed up of good and bad. You know, our best intentions are often a little bit contaminated with our self-interest. It's always entangled, right? Almost always. So then he says, wait, this is paraphrasing Pascal, wager then without hesitation that God is. There is an infinity of happy life to gain, a chance of gain against a finite number of chances of loss, and what you stake is finite. And so our proposition is of infinite force when there is the finite to stake in a game where there are equal risks of gain and loss and the infinite to gain. That's a little hard to follow. But point being, you're not going to lose if you wager that God is. But then he says, some cannot believe. They should then at least learn your inability to believe. Endeavor then to convince yourself. In other words, to act as if. To act as if. So it's just kind of what the Buddha is saying. You may as well live a good life. Either way, there's karmic retribution or not. And I would go on then and this is interesting, and maybe there's a difference between early Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism and the Bodhisattva vow that even if there is not a sort of personal karmic retribution or reward in the next life, what we do, everything we do or say or don't do or say flows forward and outward and onward beyond what we can ever know. So we need to really deeply appreciate that and act accordingly. Right? Because, as Pascal said about his wager, it's not optional. Merely by existing in this human body in the state of uncertainty that is ongoing, right? Because we don't know. We don't know for sure what will be the results of our actions. We have to choose. Even not choosing is a choice, right? So we could say, we don't know for sure what happens after death, let alone how the karma of our words and actions will play out years and years from now. If you find the doctrine of reincarnation helpful and motivating, then let it inspire you to live a wholesome life. If you don't find it believable or helpful, or you're not sure, you can be guided by your bodhisattva vows and trust that what you do and say in this life matters. Because, like those little bunnies, we are each other. We just forgot early on. The same life force flows through us as it does through those infant bunnies. That's why people want to save them. You know, that's why people work at those wildlife rescue facilities. It flows, that life force flows through the daffodils, the chickadees, and the bears coming out of hibernation. The other day, Michael's brother sent us a little video clip. It's on the CBC, I think, if you try and find it, of a grizzly bear popping his head out through the snow and then crawling out of his den onto the snow. And then just sitting there for a little while, looking around at this fresh new world, perhaps getting its bearings, remembering the world. This is beautiful. A little video of the grizzly bear coming out of the snow. And so I was looking for a poem for this morning. And here's the one I found by Mary Oliver. It's called Spring. Somewhere a black bear has just risen from sleep and is staring down the mountain. All night in the brisk and shallow restlessness of early spring, I think of her. Her four black fists flicking the gravel, her tongue like a red fire touching the grass, the cold water. There is only one question, how to love this world. I think of her rising like a black and leafy ledge to sharpen her claws against the silence of the trees. Whatever else my life is, with its poems and its music, and its glass cities, it is also this dazzling darkness coming down the mountain, breathing and tasting. All day I think of her, her white teeth, her wordlessness, her perfect love. I think maybe it's a bit of sacrilege for me to edit a poem by Mary Oliver. But I would have said, for that last line, her perfect life, and leave the love unstated, implicit, her perfect life. In the convergence of Easter, the birth of the Buddha and the coming of spring, there's something compelling about the image of birth. The egg, the chick hatching from the egg. A holy child, a baby Buddha. A Christ child who will grow up to save suffering humanity. And the story of that child's quest, which is our own quest to be free from fear and suffering. And to have that quest for freedom be for and with all beings. It cannot be otherwise, because that's the nature of existence. And that quest leads us to express something of our love for this world. Remember, Dogen said, not just practice and realization, but actualization, expression, living. And that expression might be through language, prayer, movement, sound, silence, visual form, dance. It might be through cooking, building, growing, tending, healing, repairing, mending our broken world and our broken hearts. That is the work of a bodhisattva, and we do it together. So let's continue. Thank you, everyone, for being here and for listening this morning.